Moncrief on News Talk
with Gas Networks Ireland. Natural gas is compatible with a wide range of modern appliances. gasnetworks.ie/movetogas.
Anyway, it is time for Movies and Booze, I'm delighted to say. Esther McCarthy and Tomás Clancy join us once again. Good afternoon to you both.
Hello.
Good afternoon.
And Happy New Year, Tomás.
Happy New Year.
How was your Christmas and everything?
Very well, thank you.
Say?
It was not too bad, apart from the scarlet fever. One of the children had scarlet fever, so I felt I was in a Victorian household. It was fantastic. We had scarlet fever.
Yes.
It was excellent.
Oh, God, that's a bad dose, though.
It's an annoying one, but it's, I mean, obviously there were things out there killing people, so this is treatable happily with penicillin, and it all goes away for young children.
Okay,
so
well, that's a relief. It is, though. It's depending on there's probably some sort of somebody's done as the size of your family, perhaps the relative ages of your family, and how likely it is somebody will be sick on Christmas Day.
Yes.
In my case, it's pretty much 100%. Somebody's always sick on Christmas Day, quite spectacularly this year, must be said. So today, what are we going to be talking about?
We're going to be looking at Austrian wine. Austrian wine comes in and out of fashion. What happens is that everyone tastes the wine and goes, oh, that's fantastic, and then they remember the Austrian antifreeze problem, and then they go, oh my goodness.
Yeah.
And then it becomes very successful again. People forget about that. They start drinking it. And then the Austrians somehow run out of all the cheap stuff and the price goes up. And this has been a cycle now I've watched now for about 15 years. It goes in and out and in and out of fashion. And we're looking now at Grüner Wörtlinger on the down low. So we're getting Grüner Wörtlinger from really, really sort of excellently priced, because it's fallen from fashion again.
Right.
And it really is fantastic. But in the middle of all this, the continuity element is that there are wonderful, wonderful families producing this, and it's a family-run business mostly across Austria. It's relatively small, so this particular one we're going to be looking at is one single family from the banks of the Danube near the Krems, beautiful little city of Krems, and they've been doing this since the Benedictines in the 10th century.
Oh, crikey.
Beautiful wine.
The antifreeze thing,
yes.
I mean, that's decades ago stage of the game.
It is 40 years ago, 35 years ago, and it's absolutely, it was complete and utter nonsense. It was a very small criminal element who were popping it wasn't quite antifreeze, but it was it was a material that increased the alcohol levels in German testing. And
right.
So it was really, it only went to the German market. It didn't go elsewhere. And I don't know if you were thinking about a sort of a spy service that was, never mind sort of looking at what presidents are doing, if there was a spy service out there still working in the world, one of its jobs might be to undermine the economics and the industry of another country.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems rather amusing that every so often when Austria does seem to get back onto sort of level ground, suddenly somewhere a rash of these stories get prop up in newspapers all across the world and then knock it out again.
What are you implying?
I don't know, but somebody offended, the Austrians have offended somebody somewhere along the line in a very big way.
Yeah, you can think of a number of people,
well,
actually.
Yes,
historically speaking.
More recently.
Yes. And the second wine we're talking about is
from a completely unrelated country of Argentina. Argentina had a very, very weak start after World War II as well. But they managed to get going. And what we're looking at is a really nice, very interesting Malbec. Malbec is its big, you know, sort of feature grape from Argentina. And this one is from a Bordelais negociant man whose family have been they've been Bordeaux winemakers for a couple hundred years. And he went off to find his fortune in Argentina. Back in the early 1980s, and he's built himself a very, very beautiful estate, all hand-crafted wines. Mm. And the thing about it is that this is the first, not the first, but it's one of the first truly old-world style Malbec from Argentina. Now, this will be something that people might find, you know, they might not want that. They might be happy that Argentina makes a Malbec in a very particular, very sort of beefy way. But this is a silky, cool, restrained, balanced Malbec, which is the way it used to be made in Cahors.
Oh, okay. People are already texting in wanting to know what is scarlet fever. Mike wants to know, is it like the plague?
Yeah.
Did your children have to wear a bell around their neck when they were...
Well, yes, the lowering the lowing of the children on the upper pastures as they came down with the bells banging on them was very alarming for visitors. No, I'm afraid, no, it is, it has a better name than what it actually is. It's basically strep throat for children, where it produces a burst of scarlet sort of freckles on their cheeks and neck and back. The one you have to keep an eye out for is that it obviously, you're always looking, as you know yourself, with children, anytime they get spots, you're thinking, meningitis!
Yes, of course, and the glass is out rolling on it.
So we're out there, tumblers rolling up and down, and so we brought them along to the doctor, who said, no, it's scarlet fever.
Yeah.
Take these, and we'd gone in a week.
I have a bottle of Prosecco from Artemino in Tuscany. I've had it since 2007. It was their dearer bottle. Will it go off, improve, or stay as it was? Simon wants to know.
It might already be past its peak. That's what that's what that noise means, and I apologise. Yes,
I've a marked Caqueras 94 Reserva I found in the press. Can I drink it? Gary wants to know.
Yes, that's thank you. That's a Rioja, and it's a very, they're a very good house. Sort of 94. Oh, that could be very nice. It'll be starting to be a little bit lighter, a little bit pale when you pour it out. Very silky, and don't shake it around too much because they throw a bit of sediment there as they get over the 10 and 15 years of age. Perfectly drinkable. Yeah. Should be.
What is the life expectancy of a Prosecco?
A Prosecco, really not as long as, for instance, champagne.
Yeah.
Because of the way that they make it using the Charmat method, which essentially you can make sparkling wine in a couple of ways, and one of them involves inserting the bubbles or making it in one huge tank, and you get kind of larger bubbles. And those larger bubbles, it's more like Coca-Cola type interaction between themselves and the material there, rather than champagne, which is a secondary fermentation in every single bottle.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you get very tiny bubbles, and they tend to be able to, they can last longer. I've had champagnes from the 1960s, been very privileged to have some, and they're really rather beautiful, very delicate, very fine bubbles, but you know, they're really still beautiful. I've found it very hard to find a Prosecco that's more than 10 years old that maintains its vivacity, the bubbles element of it. So, you know, most are meant to be drunk within a couple of years. Some of the better ones can easily last a decade. If you're pushing on a little bit further than that, as that is, then you're in a bit of trouble. See, I think of 2007 as yesterday.
It's not 2007.
and it turns out it's 11 years ago. You know, so that's the problem for me.
Yes, time's cruel march, unfortunately. Our hashtag, by the way, is Temple Bar Movies, Crouching Jaeger, Hidden Flagon, many more similar to that. Along with texts about scarlet fever and its historical dangers. That's what happens when you mention anything.
Right, yes.
It goes off into a side route there. Can you ask your movie reviewer, that's you, Esther, what's the best bad movie that she's seen? Now, I'm looking to curl up on the couch this weekend with some terrible movies, so I'm welcoming any suggestions.
Oh, guilty pleasures. I'll have to have a think about that. Yeah.
John Wick 2 was pretty bad.
It has to be so bad it's good again. So it has to go beyond being merely bad.
People have that. Well, The Room, the disaster artist is like, is chronically bad.
Yeah. Yeah. So I'm dying to see that after seeing the disaster.
I've seen clips of The Room, and it's just, and I could see really maybe, like, there's a scene where they're kind of on a rooftop for some reason, and for no apparent reason, there's a small shed, like a potting shed you'd have in your back garden, in a corner of this roof.
Yeah.
And then so they're cutting back to two people who are sitting together having a conversation. Sometimes they're standing, sometimes they're sitting. And then somebody emerges from the shed, has a conversation with them, and then disappears.
Yeah.
And then somebody else emerges from the shed, and it makes no sense whatsoever. And you know, at the end, 17 people have been hiding in the shed on a roof for no reason whatsoever. Now, that might appeal to people, but eventually you'd find it annoying.
Yeah, I'm not sure. Maybe I watch too many bad films for a living, but I'm not sure I subscribe to something being bad enough to be enjoyable.
Yeah.
Like, why would you bother when there are so many great movies out there to see?
Yeah.
You know?
I just turned on News Talk TV. I didn't know Tomas was such an emo with his stripy hood. He sounds so posh and refined, and then his hoodie comes out of nowhere. Rock on, Tomas, says Debbie.
Tomas is street.
Yeah. He's street. He's very street. Yeah. he's gonna, his homies are downstairs looking dangerous.
I saw
Logan Lucky finally, speaking of annoying, during the week. It's not that the film was annoying. It was just the night we chose to watch it was the night of one of those big storms, and the wind was hitting the house so hard I couldn't feckin' hear the telly for most of it. So I did enjoy it. I would have enjoyed it more, I think, if I could have heard everything that was being said.
It's just, I know it's kind of a bit burn after reading, but it's just such fun.
Or a bit Fargo-ish, perhaps. Yeah. Eimear says, Esther seen Lady Bird yet? Apologies if you've already reviewed it. Mad to see it. Love Saoirse Ronan. Really hope she does well this weekend at the Globes.
I'll be seeing it next week. So I'm looking forward to seeing that. We're not getting it here till late February. It's already in release in the US, but it's not getting released in this part of the world till late February.
Right.
So the Oscars and everything will be over by the time
we get
to see her in it. Yeah. So
it is astounding, though. How old is she? 21?
23.
She's 23.
She gets an Oscar nomination in a couple of weeks' time, it'll be her third Oscar nomination. And
that's
the Golden Globes are on Sunday night, and I think Getches are bets on now on Saoirse, because I think she's going to win the Golden Globe on Sunday night. Because, well, first of all, I haven't seen the performance, but based on lots of stuff, like the acting Globe is divided into two categories. One's for comedy and musical, and one is for drama. And I think her biggest competition is Frances McDormand, who's absolutely brilliant.
In Three Billboards.
But Frances is in the drama category and Saoirse is in comedy category. So her main contestant there, I think, is Margot Robbie, who is brilliant in I, Tonya. But I just feels like Saoirse's got the wind behind her at the moment. You know, I think she's going to get her Golden Globe on Sunday.
And have you seen Three Billboards as well?
I have seen it. It's super. Yeah.
Yeah.
We'll be talking about it next week, actually.
But this is the normal thing. This seems to happen every year. There's a glut of really good movies around this time of the year as they're getting them out in advance of the Oscar nominations.
Oh, yeah. Now's the time to get to the pictures. Yeah, there's lots of good stuff coming up in the next few weeks.
Capricorn 1 is my guilty pleasure every Christmas. It even has O.J. Simpson. I didn't think Capricorn was such a bad movie.
It's a good movie.
Oh, that was a good movie.
I've never seen it.
Yeah, it's about they're supposed to send the first manned mission. It's 25 years old at least. They're supposed to send a manned mission to 77, apparently, when it came out, to Mars. And then they've realised that they can't do it. But because of the political pressures, they decide to fake the whole thing. And they coerce the three astronauts into going into a soundstage and pretending they're on Mars. And then the astronauts escape.
Like Stanley Kubrick did with the real life.
With the moon landing, yeah. But one of those astronauts is O.J. Simpson. The weird thing, though, is how... I suppose, and it'd be interesting because we'll be talking about this in the light of all the money in the world. But how many movies, like, there's a non-stop Christmas movie channel and my kids are watching and there's O.J. Simpson. Yeah. Oh my God. When I told them who he was and what he'd done, they were kind of put them in an un-Christmassy mood.
Yeah,
really.
That's for sure,
after that. I watched Room expecting it to be terrible. It's not that bad. Actually, I felt let down. Says Garrett, I don't know why you were expecting Room to be terrible. Again, it's an excellent movie. Jamie says Starship Troopers is the best bad movie.
It is. There's a lot of pleasure in that movie.
I think think it's good fun. Starship Troopers.
I think it is too. I mean, it's kind of intentionally got its tongue in its cheek.
Absolutely.
Really,
that it's
kind of over the top. Another text says the U.S. critics are slating Three Billboards, saying it's misogynist and Frances McDormand is the only good thing in it.
The reviews have been. There is a divisiveness, but they've been overwhelmingly popular, like good reviews. I absolutely loved it. There are things about it that people won't like. There are elements to it that people won't like. It's kind of like when Wes Anderson was accused of being too Wes Anderson-y, and then he went off and went like peak Wes Anderson with the Grand Budapest Hotel. I think Martin McDonagh, the things maybe you don't like about certain elements to his film, he goes full Martin McDonagh in this film, but I just went along with him. I absolutely loved it.
Right, but
it's very talky.
Yeah.
You know, he's often accused of being kind of a bit Tarantino-esque, and there's a lot of that going on. But I think there is a great heart. There's a ferocity to it, but there's a great heart to it as well. And it's thanks to Frances McDormand's performance largely, I think.
Yeah. Somebody's nominated Left Behind from 2014 as a crime movie. Now, you probably won't know it. I didn't know it either. I just looked it up. It's got Nicolas Cage in it. But yeah,
I've seen it. It's awful.
But then again, just why didn't he just text in any Nicolas Cage movie in the last 10 years? Right, we have to take a break. Back in a couple of minutes.
53106 is our text number. That will cost you 30 cents. You can follow us on Facebook or Twitter or send us an email to afternoon@newstalk.com. It is that time of a Friday afternoon, that which means it's movies and booze time. Tomas and Esther are with us this week. Sticky from Drimna says, because somebody did text in to ask about bad movies, and inevitably people sent in their suggestions for bad movies and then other people disagreed with them. Sticky from Drimna says, Capricorn 1 rocked. Elliot Gould, Telly Savalas, menacing helicopters, a hungry dude forced to eat a snake. What's not to like? Couldn't agree more. Myself and Tomas totally agree with you. Mike in Galway says, Atomic Blonde. I wasted €11 on Sky Box. It's €11? On Sky Box Office last weekend and gave up after 35 minutes. Wine didn't help. That's how bad it was.
Wine didn't help. That is very bad.
Yeah, it works well as an action film and Charlize Theron's badass, but it's kind of, there's a coldness and a deadness to it that never really shakes off. It takes itself incredibly seriously, which is not really what you want from a movie like that. And I had one major believability issue as well. She's an undercover agent, but she already looks like Charlize Theron. And then she's wearing this like really blonde wig and sunglasses and very sexy fur coats and mini skirts and stuff. And I was going, sure, how would she be able to go undercover anywhere looking like that?
Like that, yes. Good you know? Point.
And then I could never kind of...
There's Charlize Theron wearing a disguise. Look, people are getting... Somebody's texting, good point. People are getting mixed up with both films called Room. You might clarify this as the recent one. Yes, we're talking about...
Room is Lenny Abrahamson's masterpiece. Yeah, exactly. And The Room is the...
The worst film, terrible film. And Room being the more recent one, which is the excellent one. The Disaster Artist is about The Room, which is the earlier one. Now, yes, totally confused now. All of the establishing shots in The Room, that's the bad one, which is supposed to be set in San Diego or of San Francisco. You know a movie will be good when that happens. Texter says, my son was born in August 2000. I'm looking for a good wine or champagne so we can celebrate when he hits 18. Any suggestions?
An infinite amount of them. That was probably the best year for the last 20, was the year 2000. They are shockingly expensive at this point in time. The idea is that you should buy it within a year or so of the child being born.
It's late now.
And
then
you have it because you're really building in the price. However, you can have a look at Cru Bourgeois, Chasseblin and Peugeot. They are really around sort of 50, 60 euros a bottle, and they're really, they're absolutely excellent. It's a way to taste Bordeaux 2000 for that kind of price. If money's no object, then obviously the one to go for is the Lynch Barge or Chateau Latour, which is, you know, a couple of thousand for the bottle.
Thanks very much.
It's a very, very fine, one of the finest Latour for some time.
Would it be possible, though, for him to get a wine that says August 2000 on it?
Well, you can. What you'll be able to do is you'll be able to find a bottle, a champagne bottle, and what it'll have is the disgorgement date, and it'll give you months. But most of the rest of the bottles, they've just bottled for the year. And what you're looking at is that, so when they're saying 2000 on it, in fact, it will have only been bottled probably in 2001, 2002, because it'll have been in barrel for the next year and a half or so forth.
Yeah.
So if you wanted to do the bottling thing, I would go champagne. There's, you know, have a look at sort of the Bollinger, the Grand Dernier, or, you know, any of the other sort of top vintage ones, and you'll see that they have a disgorgement date that will give you that kind of month. But you know, that's about it, unfortunately.
Yeah.
And the other one is that if you're ever looking to do something for a child that's just been born, if you're after the halfway period through the year, you can get that vintage from the New World. So Argentine, you know, sort of Australian 2017s were available from around about July, August last year in 2017. And that can be fun to turn up to a christening of somebody in November with something from 2017.
Absolutely.
From their actual year.
I was given a bottle of La Rioja Alta Gran Reserva 2007. Was thinking of keeping it for my daughter, who was born in 2007. Will it keep for, say, another 10 years?
Absolutely. Now, that's a very good bottle of wine. wine. La Rioja Alta is, they are the Latour of the Rioja business. You'll see on it, you'll have some, it'll say 904 or 607. There's another number that's on that bottle, and that indicates one of the two very exceptional vineyards that they have in relation to it. That 07, I've seen wines that are 20, 30, 40 years old from La Rioja Alta. So hang on to that. Perfect. No problem at all.
Believability issues. Charlize and James McAvoy walking down the street like they're the same height in Atomic Blonde. Okay. I'll leave Nicolas Cage alone. I really like him. He can be so brilliant when he wants to be. He just hasn't felt like it in such a long time. Gaz in Dublin says, there's a Nicolas Cage film called Joe, and he's very good in it. He can pull it out of the bag when needed. Which one is Joe?
Joe, I saw. It's fairly recent. I can't recall it, but I remember thinking he was really good in it.
Yeah. No, I mean, he has been very good. It's just like one of those. It seemed to be like, you know, putting Nicolas Cage's name on a film guarantees straight to video.
Yeah.
Really.
He just made a lot of bad action movies. And once you become known for that, it's hard to step away from it, isn't it?
There's a low-budget martial arts film called Fatal Deviation, set in Trim, County Meath. That's so bad it's enjoyable. It's absolutely hilarious. It was written, produced and starred in by one lad, Gas. Outtakes are even better. God, we must find that. that's the winning suggestion so far for So Bad It's Good, Fatal Deviation. Tucker and Dale versus Evil, surprisingly good. Okay, we're getting very obscure now. Myself and herself and our 20-something daughters were all ill on Christmas Day. Nothing to do, of course, with overindulging in Tomás's excellent festive wine tips, says John in Limerick. The man on the train, Larry Mullen version, there is a line that sums up the movie. Larry's character says, it just doesn't feel right. It doesn't, says Mike. Right, let's move on to let's move to Austria. Austria. Is it for our first wine?
Excellent. So we're now on the banks of the Danube, and we're on the south bank of the Danube near the city, the small city of Krems. And this is Weingut Müller, and it's a Grüner Wörtlinger, and it's brought in by Thomas Woodbury of Middle Street in Galway. And they bring in quite a few wines of their own. Very, very good shop. It's also available nationwide as well on woodbury's.ie, quickly hastens to add, in case there's any feels that this pro-Galway announcement is too specific. This is the Grüner Wörtlinger I was suggesting at the beginning of the show, that we've got the pricing has come back to somewhere that is, you know, really very attractive. This is €14.95, about €15. The feature of the wine is that it exhibits what people describe as minerality. Now, this is like a red rag to a bull. This is a Twitter storm in a bottle when you mentioned the word minerality. I eventually just had to stop on my 27th reply to sort of a Twitter storm about the word minerality. The word minerality has been criticized, as you might imagine, by scientists and particularly people who would object to, you know, words being used in wine in a very strange way, or in an odd way, or in a way that's unsubstantiated. So when you say things like there's tones of strawberry in this wine, when there is no strawberry in the wine, then clearly people will object. So when you talk about minerality and we're talking about minerals, they're going to say there are no minerals in the wine. There is no rock in the wine. There's no slate in the wine. Now, what they are misunderstanding, he quickly defends himself before the backlash happens, is what we're looking at is that these are signifiers.
Yeah, so it's metaphorical language.
Exactly. So minerality, or if you say that something has a slate-like sort of feature, and you're thinking, when I taste this wine, it has this kind of stony element to it. It's very dry, very lip-smacking, very crisp, very precise wine. And that's what you'd expect from Austria, in fact, very precise and crisp and clean. Now, that's exactly what I take out of it. And I do so, and I call that, you know, this crispness and this slap back to the back of the tongue has this mineral tone to it. But it's a signifier. That's what I get from a taste from wine that's been planted on this stony soil with a bit of earth on the very wet, soft, deep earth on top of it. And it gets this, it gives me this taste. When I taste something from the Moselle, if you taste a Riesling from Moselle, you think, well, that's very slate-like. And the reason why is because our ancestors, looking around, got, what does that taste like? And they look around and every bit of the vineyard's covered in slate, and they go, slaty. Because
yes.
They're at a period in time when they're thinking about the ether and the ether surrounding everything, and they think it flows into everything. And so that was the way in a pre-scientific world, where of them suggesting that what we're looking at in here reflects what they see on the ground, except they're just simply saying the soil, and that's what they mean by terroir. In reality, what we're looking at in Austria, in this region which is called Kremstal, is a hugely complex ecosystem of climate and wind and temperature and warmth and all of the other things. And that is impacting on the taste of the wine. Not any one thing, but if for shorthand for our ancestors, they would have said, oh, it's very, it has this sort of minerality to it. What they mean is that the complex sort of interaction of soil, for instance, the soil, absorbs heat and it warms up. If it's very thick and kind of glutinous and a bit clay-like, it will actually retain that that heat. And so when the sun disappears, the warmth slowly moves back up towards the top. It cools down at a slower rate than if you had a bit of dry sand, which can be roasting during the day. It gets very cold very quickly.
Mm.
You see the same with stones. In Chateauneuf de Pape, they have these stones the size of bread loaves called galettes. They get roasting hot during the day, and what happens is, as it cools down at night, and because you're in a beautiful hot place, there's no cloud, that's it's the big just sun, when the sun goes down, it freezes. But in fact, these warm stones radiate heat up, and they're like sort of a hot water bottle. Exactly. And they keep the plants all warm, and they keep the temperature up. And what you find is that you get fully ripe wine, fully ripe grapes at the end of a period, which it shouldn't really be that way because it gets cold at night and it should take them a lot longer. So in these kind of marginal countries, marginal is not the right word, but in these countries where the temperature is not the absolute ideal for growing grapes, like Austria, as you're heading a little bit north and a little bit further into their continental climate where they get freezing cold winters with plenty of snow that they're experiencing right now, you get this warmth to them from the soils that have been planted on. So all of that is by way of saying this is a very, very linear, crisp and clean wine that's playing in the same field as Sauvignon Blanc. It gives you that crisp kind of response, and it's lip smacking. It's inducing a little sort of saliva as you're tasting it. And it was going, Grunewertlinger looked like it was going to win that battle and finally knock Sauvignon Blanc off its perch as being the sort of the glass in hand wine for the entire population of wine drinkers. But I'm afraid it didn't. And part of the reason there was the price elevated very quickly and turned it into a very expensive wine rather quickly. They got huge competition from the New World, so from New Zealand and from the Finger Lakes and Oregon and New York, places like that, which have now become very fashionable to have your Grunewertlinger from. So poor old Austria was back on the back foot again as being a place that produced it, but it's without too much sort of the glamorous sort of element to it.
And it seems difficult for Austria to compete price-wise.
It's very
with the new world, say, anyway.
They can't. That's exactly right. It's, it's a country trapped by five other countries, one of which is Switzerland. Everywhere is places that people want to live. It's very beautiful. It's very expensive. They have one of the highest standards of living in the world, which means that they're, the land is very expensive. That's actually functional. So if you want to make cheap wine, you need very cheap land and you need to be, you're paying your workers modest incomes. These people are all family-run entities. So there's three families living in one house here, or three generations of one family living in the house, sort of grandfather, father and children. They're all making the wines, but they're also their nurses and doctors, and they do other things as well. They come back to the house in the evening.
Okay.
It's the Walton's wine.
Yeah.
And it's a really, really gorgeous Grunewertlinger from Austria, Weingut Müller.
It's very nice, I must say.
Lovely.
Absolutely lovely. I have a bottle of 2000 Mouton Rothschild that I got as a present for my 50th birthday. It has been carefully stored in temperature control. It has become too expensive to possibly enjoy drinking it, I feel. Any idea where I could sell it in Dublin?
In Dublin, it's tricky to sell a single bottle. I mean, that's the key thing. However, Mouton Rothschild, if you're going to sell a single bottle, your Mouton Rothschild is going to be it. You should be looking at it should be an engraved bottle with gold engraving of a lamb on it. So it's one of the first ones that it's a very special bottle, the 2000 for them. I would bring it, if you're of any chance of having a look at somebody sourcing this, you want to bring it to maybe Mitchell's and Sons, who are out in Glastool or in the the IFC and the CHQ, CHQ and the IFC. Mm. They've been dealing with sort of very upmarket, very excellent wines for, you know, for 200 years or so now.
And about how much might it be worth?
Oh, I mean, you're looking at a couple of grand.
Really? You know, for those. I was going to say, is this guilt justified? But maybe it is.
It is. Yeah. I mean, I think it went on sale at around about 400 or 500, and its demand goes up and down for them. There's a stock market. There's a stock market in these very expensive wines, and you'd be looking at quite expensive for that. But it's all about provenance, unfortunately. Mm. So what you'll find is somebody has it in a beautiful presentation bottle that they've got photographs of it having sat in a cellar for the last 20 years, in which case they're going to get the 17 years. They'll be getting the big bucks for it. But, you know, a few hundred euros very happily, very easily would be available for that. I'm sure anyone would be happy to pay that kind of money.
Wow. Huey just tweeted there, "Oh, stony grey wine of Mullen." Recently spent a weekend in Budapest and enjoyed the local vintages. Are there any places in Dublin where Hungarian wine is on sale?
Yes, there are. You can have, first of all, in the Polish shops. So if you have a look at, you know, the Polish supermarket shops, you'll find that they have definitely a few Hungarian wines that you wouldn't think of very immediately. And then they import them specifically because, in fact, Hungary was a big supplier of wine to Poland. They're a bit too far north for their own vineyards, but this is quite close. So Hungary and the Czech Republic and a bit of the Slovak Republic all supplied wines there. So first have a look in the Polish shops. That's the way to go there. For the fine wine side of it, any good shop, any good wine shop around the country will have them. So back to Mitchell's, as we've just mentioned them.
Yeah.
They'll have, for instance, they have Tokaj, which is obviously Hungarian.
Yes.
And they also have Bull's Blood, which is a red wine from Hungary as well. And there's a lot of white wine from around Lake Balaton, which is available out there, some of it actually in supermarkets. So there is a bit of Hungarian wine. It's not widespread. There's, you know, definitely not saying that. But if you have a little look in the specialist wine shops, you'll certainly find a few bottles.
My son was born 6 weeks ago. Can you advise a good bottle of 2017 red wine that I could open on his 18th and 21st? Around 150 quid, Jack in Mullingar says.
It's going to be trickier for people for 2017. It was not a great vintage. You know, it was just not a great vintage. Think about the summer and what kind of summer we had. And even though we're on a marginal region, it wasn't great anywhere, to be honest.
Yeah, okay.
But Burgundy is going to be where you'd be looking for. Or I do hear that there was a pretty good port production, and there might well be some very good. Have a look out for the port side of this, but it'll be another year or two before you'll see those put into bottle. So you've got plenty of time to for this to mature into an idea.
Charlie wants to know if you can get a Merlot Brazilian red wine here in Ireland.
Brazilian red wine is taken in by McEnway importers. I'm not sure that they have that particular brand, but you'll find a few Brazilian wines in some of the independent off-licenses. I think Martins of Fairview might have one, but McEnway is the name of the importer if you're very, you know, very interested.
Yeah.
You could move in that direction.
A recent visit to Bologna, I was very much enjoyed the local Pignoletto, which is a light Frizzante wine. Can it be sourced in Dublin?
No, that's very hard to find. Basically every small region in Italy, well, they believe that they make the best of every single conceivable thing. as the late great Paolo Tullio would have told us, his own region made the very best of sparkling wine as well. Very hard to find them outside of that region because, again, they all drink their own.
Yeah. Right, okay, we're going to have to take a break. Our hashtag, by the way, is Temple Bar Movies. A river of piss runs through it, for instance. What movie would you like to do for us,
Esther? Oh, let's do All the Money in the World. The story behind us is almost as interesting as the story of it.
Indeed, right, we'll do All the Money in the World after this.
They will do things to Paul that cannot be undone for any amount of money. We have to pay.
This simply isn't possible. My financial position has changed.
Really? I mean, 30 seconds ago, you said it was a good day. I mean, I'm not all that bright, but I can multiply as well as you. With oil up as much as it was this morning, you have amassed another fortune.
Well, what if the embargo is lifted and oil were to crash? I'd be exposed. I have never been more vulnerable financially than I am right now.
Mr. Getty, with all due respect, nobody has ever been richer than you are at this moment.
I have no money to spare.
What would it take? I mean, what would it take for you to feel secure?
More.
Mm. That's, as you heard there, Christopher Plummer in All the Money in the World, and not Kevin Spacey, obviously. And that was, there was already a frisson of controversy around this film, as Spacey filmed everything for this movie originally.
Yeah, it was, it's like, this is an extraordinary achievement in filmmaking, and Ridley Scott's a bit of a legend in my book after what he's done here. And his attitude towards the whole thing actually has been kind of hilariously brilliant. But it was all done. It was wrapped. It was locked down. It's scheduled to, it's coming out here this weekend, but it was scheduled to be released in the US on just before Christmas, so that it would qualify for the Oscars. So they had even little less time to turn this around here. And I suppose what's interesting to me is the speed at which Ridley Scott acted. Within 4 hours of Kevin Spacey's story breaking, he had locked down his locations for reshoots. He'd been on the phone going, are these locations still available? We need to reshoot scenes here. And that night he met Christopher Plummer in the Four Seasons in Los Angeles and offered him the part. So that's how quickly he acted. And he said in interviews since, you know, I didn't go yippee, but I did go into battle mode. That's how I direct. I go into battle mode. And, you know, obviously it was an option as well to delay the release of the film, which would have taken a lot of pressure off everyone. But he was very aware that Danny Boyle is doing a show, a TV series on the John Paul Getty case, which airs in January. And he wasn't going to be second, basically.
Right. OK. Yeah.
So that was it. Truck ahead and do all these reshoots in, I think, 9 days in total. And I mean,
knowing that and then watching the movie, can you see the joins? Is there any bit where it looks like the back of Kevin Spacey's head?
It brings a great frisson to the film, though. It does, because you're there imagining what another actor would be like. And it's an extraordinary story, really, you know. But not only, like, I was surprised by how much they must have had to reshoot, because not only is Christopher Plummer's character far more front and centre than I expected, given the amount of time they had to reshoot. I thought he was, you know, going to be kind of a big character, but not in many scenes. He's in lots of scenes. He's in a lot of this film. But also they'd have had to shoot every interaction his character had with any other character. So they had to bring back Michelle Williams and Mark Wahlberg, who are both pretty great here actually as well. And they've just knocked it out of the park. Like, it's great. But Scott has said, like, that he tends to rattle through his films, and there was a great interview with him in the Sunday Times where he said he you know, he does 60 or 80 setups and or scenes a day, and that's the way he likes it. And he said, directors who faff about need slapping. There's a lot of pondering. I don't do 9-15 takes. If you're doing 20 takes, you don't know what the bleep you're doing.
Yeah.
So that's his attitude. And he then said later in the interview, I'm supposed to say it was an absolute nightmare, but actually it was all pretty straightforward. the best thing, I'm fascinated as to what Kevin Spacey would have brought to it, I suppose. But what Christopher Plummer brings to the character John Paul Getty is a kind of benign creepiness, I suppose. He's kind of a smiling villain. And, you know, when you realise the implications for his own grandson, which we'll go into shortly, but, you know, the fact that he is kind of, he almost chortles when he says he's not going to give any money. Like, they ask him how much would he be willing to give, and he just says nothing, with a little chuckle. Yeah. There's a grandfatherly chuckle to him, and it's kind of, you know, it's really eerie. And it's not a statement, I think, that he's gotten a Golden Globe nomination on Sunday night for his performance here. I think it's totally unmerited. I think he's great in it. And to have knocked it out of the park like that so quickly, having not even read the script.
Yeah,
like,
I suppose you could see how Spacey would do something similar as well, because Spacey, you know, I suppose his special thing is unsympathetic characters.
Absolutely. Maybe it would have been more of a stretch for Plummer, though, shall we say. And just, but it's a fascinating story. I think I liked it more because I wasn't very familiar with the story of the Getty kidnappings. They were just a little bit before my time. So maybe people who are very familiar with the story won't get as much of a welt out of it as I did. But I thought it was great, I have to say. It opens in Rome with young Paul Getty, the billionaire's grandson, being kidnapped and bundled into a car by a gang of criminals, where he's kept and held for several months, as it emerges. And his mother is played by Michelle Williams, great as always, who is kind of estranged from the Getty family. She's broke up with John Paul's father and Plummer's character's son long before, and it was a real sticking point for Getty Senior that he didn't get family custody of the son. So that's kind of there, you know, looming large for many years. But what is astonishing is kind of like she tries to, I suppose William's character, she tries to inveigle herself back into family. Why wouldn't you? Your son's been held hostage by a gang, you know, who are threatening to cut bits of his body off. So she tries initially to inveigle herself back into the family and then just to try and really push and push the idea of a custody agreement. And it gets more and more frantic. And, you know, people who remember the details in the time know some nasty stuff goes down. Then Mark Wahlberg plays this kind of ex-CIA character who's a top advisor to Getty, and who's, you know, who feels he can use the power of persuasion over time to persuade him to pay out a ransom, and who grows increasingly frustrated with him, even though he's the boss, as time goes on. And I suppose there were two things. Some don't like the casting of Wahlberg. I had no issue with it. I thought he was fine in it. He'd maybe a little bit too modern an actor to play in a period film, but I still thought he was good. Now I believed him in it. And the other thing is, I suppose, Plummer's performance is great, but you never really get to the heart of why this character would not pay the ransom.
Yes.
You know,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
And maybe there's no heart to get to, though. That's, you know, maybe it is,
this is
just
true. Yeah.
A film about greed and wealth and power and, you know, not being used to have people saying no to you. So I thought it was a fascinating film in that regard, and it's definitely deserves to be regarded as much more.
Does the film imply that he had any love for his grandson? Or was it just about, you're not going to tell me what to do, I'm not going to give you any money?
He speaks of his love for his grandson a lot, but you never see any instance of, you know, where he's freaking out, I suppose.
Yeah, he's telling, but he's not showing any love.
So it's a fascinating portrait, and it deserves to be regarded for all the fun of not that it's funny, but for all the fascination, I suppose, of remaking, recasting and remaking all these scenes, and what a great story it is in terms of filmmaking. Like, it's much more than the film that Kevin Spacey got booted out of. Like, it's a great drama in its own right, I think.
Someone says, I heard the Ridley Scott interviewed on this. He hinted at the possibility of an eventual DVD release that would contain both the Spacey and Plummer cuts of the movie.
He certainly did.
Quite the bonus feature.
Yeah, he didn't rule it out. And he said, I don't see it happening for a long time, is what he said. But
that would be interesting.
It would
in
be
a somewhat macabre sort of way, it must be said. Just going back to Fatal Deviation, this is this movie that was, I think, made someplace in Navan. I hear Fatal Deviation is a classic of the bad genre. The star is a Van Damme disciple. We used to have Fatal Deviation parties back in the day. Make it a must-see, says Cormac in Navan. Someone else says, your texter failed to mention it stars Mikey Graham in his breakthrough and final acting role. We did not know that either. It gets more and more intriguing. Inland, and the subject of bad movies, Inland Empire by David Lynch is one film that was pretty painful to watch. Then I realised I was sitting on the remote control. Says no one texter. How odd. Somebody has a question for you, which I can't find here. Well, Jean-Claude Van Damme, this is another bad film, in Knock Off. It's about counterfeit jeans. It's embarrassing, but actually good. Says Ken in Dublin.
I love those 80s action movies.
Yeah.
I love them.
Knock off, really. Have you seen Hunt for the Wilder People? It's a genuinely good movie set in New Zealand. The director did the most recent Thor. It's on Netflix. That was some years old, I think.
Taki Waititi, he's he's a great talent. He starred in and directed it. Or did he star in it? No, he didn't star in it. It's lovely. It's a really sweet film with Sam Neill and a wayward boy who go off into the wilderness together. And it's I'm liking the people who saw Thor and went, what did this guy make before? Because he's done a brilliant job with Thor. Are going back now and finding
this. Okay, that's interesting. Yes, is Dom Perignon 1998 worth anything? Niamh wants to know.
Unfortunately, the vintage, I don't know the vintages off by heart. I should from 1998. I'm surprised. I didn't realize there was a 1998. But if there, first of all, Dom Perignon is the vintaged top line mark of the Moët & Chandon Champagne estate. Dom Perignon is the man who didn't invent champagne, but was paid by the engaged by the monastery to find out why the corks were flying out of the bottles and the English were sending back the wine saying they weren't paying for it. So he was there, he was sent to see could they get rid of this, and he discovered why it was happening and then could show that it could be made. Then they invented the wire thing to keep the bottle in and so forth. It's a great, great wine. The 1990 is one of the, you know, the absolute best that I've ever tasted, is still great and is well priced. But they don't tend to go for ridiculous prices. They're more, you know, they're kind of €400-500.
That's for a bottle or a case?
For a bottle.
For a bottle, yeah.
When you get to the older, you know, if you're buying older vintages. So I think, one, that will be, you know, if you're looking for later vintage, you know, something after 1990, you're probably looking at the €400-500 sort of mark. Unfortunately, I can't give a tasting note for 1998. I apologize.
Actually, Anne called with a similar thing. She's a magnum of Moët. Would it be safe to drink? It's about 14 years old. If so, would it have any value?
Yeah. Now,
the same answer.
Yeah, no value. That Moët, right? So Moët is probably the Brut. It's probably the Brut Imperial. And if it's the Brut Imperial, that's non-vintage. But in fact, it really gets a bit of toasty nuttiness if you can leave it the non-vintage for 6 or 7 or 8 years, and I often do. There's no real value in trying to sell that as a single bottle, but you will find that a really nutty, attractive, and or potentially attractive wine.
Great. Okay, we have one more movie, one more wine to go after this. 53106 is our text number. That will cost you 30 cents. On the subject of bad movies, Rory says Tom Cruise's Mummy film last year had to be one of the worst I've ever seen. Close as I've come to leaving the cinema early. Convoluted nonsense.
Yes, I agree.
Okay, there you go.
Except for Sophia Boutella, who played the actual mummy character, and I've seen her in a couple of other movies this year, and she is ridiculously beautiful but also really talented, and I look forward to when she starts getting decent roles, which she should be getting offered by now, to seeing what she's going to do.
On the same subject, Rory in Sligo says, I haven't actually seen it, so maybe it doesn't qualify, but Greg Kinnear was in a movie about the guy who invented intermittent window wipers. The trailer is hilariously bad, and when they can't even make the trailer bad, you know the film must be awful. Says, I've never heard of that.
No, and I love Greg
actually
Kinnear.
Sounds kind of fascinating, though, at the same time. I watched Get Out last night. Divine Jesus, is there a more uncomfortable movie to watch? Great stuff. Says Brandon.
Yeah, it's great. I mean, it wasn't on my top 10 of the year. It featured on a hell of a lot of it was a horror movie, but told
it's through, Guess Who's Coming to Dinner slasher movie.
But told through a very different racial prism that maybe we are more used to than we should be. So it was good, clever.
Right, our second wine of the day. Where are we going now?
We're going to Argentina, he says, taking a very fast flight over the long distance water there, and the strange connection between Europe and Argentina. There's a lot of Italian wine produced in Argentina because a lot of Italian people actually founded Buenos Aires and so forth. So there's a big Italianate part to it. And you know, there's lovely wines coming out that we don't just see here. Paso Doble, kind of Amarone-style wines from Argentina. What we've fixated on from Argentina is really Malbec. And Malbec has been an absolute, it's been a slam dunk of a wine for the Irish market. It's big, it's beefy, it's very spicy, it's very dark and very strong. And it is, it's been a runaway seller, been an absolute runaway seller in this country. So here I am trying to go against that, and I apologize in advance. So here's a wine that will be hated by anyone who loves those kind of big, enormous Malbecs. This is a very lean, calm, quiet, cool Malbec. And this is made by a Frenchman. And this Frenchman, Hervé Fabre. This is Fabre Montmayou Reserve Malbec from Argentina. It's available in Whelan's Wines in Lachlanstown and nationwide on online and so forth. It's around €15 as well, so €14.95, €15. There's a Grand Reserva version, which is a little bit more muscular on top of that, and they make some very, very very fine wines. This is bringing the sensibilities of French wine to the Argentinian to Mendoza, which is the largest sort of area there. It's 1,500 meters in the sky. I mean, that's the first thing to think about. You're talking a kilometer and a half up into the air. And I always like to think about that. If you live in Ireland, you know, we all live in between zero, or if you're in Galway, minus 5 meters below the water level, right up to a couple of hundred meters. And Carrantoul, you know, is good. You're talking higher than Carrantoul for some of these vineyards. So we're planting up there. And what you do when you go to height is you get, you assuage the heat of the day. So they are in a pretty hot sort of zone, but because they're so high up, it gives you this moderated sort of area. Secondly, incredibly crisp, fast-flowing air from the icy Andes coming down. So you get cold and cool, dry, very clean air. So it's like a Swiss clinic for wine. you know, it's where you put wines that have real troubles. Malbec has always been a troubled grape. It has tight bunches. It's susceptible to mildew and rot and all kinds of other things. And so it's really worked well in Cahors and in the southwest of France, where they got a bit of breeze and a bit of sun. And it was used by Bordeaux to beef up Bordeaux wines, because Bordeaux wines are an assembly. They make wines by mixing up a lot of different grapes. Because the same way, if you were making a pizza, you're making some sort of a beautiful sauce for pasta. If you just threw a load of tomatoes onto the top and said, "There you go, there's the tomato sauce," it's tomatoey sauce.
Yeah.
But we know that if you put in a bit of bay leaf, some brown sugar, a little bit of vinegar, you're making really great tomato sauce by having these extra things to it. So Bordeaux is all about that. They have Cabernet Sauvignon, but they put a dab of Malbec, a dab of Petit Verdot, and they make a more complex and rich wine. So Malbec on its own, what it does is it has very strong tannins. It has really strong tannins, but they can become a bit luscious and a bit opulent if you get warm weather. So that's where the Bordeaux used it. They used it for the tannins and a bit of warmth, kind of a booster to their own wines in weak years. This was brought down by French emigres to Argentina. They went up very high. They cured all the mildew problems and all the other problems it has with it. And with that extra bit of heat, they got the spice out of it. So what we have is a clean, spicy version of this, but without the big, enormous weight that you get from other people. So that's it. It's a fine wine, very reserved, very restrained, as you might imagine, a sort of a Franco-Argentinian take on Malbec.
Yeah, worth a look. Sometimes a Malbec can be something of a blunt instrument, much more subtle. Yeah. That's lovely. Right, we'll move on to our second wine of the day. It is Hostiles. Here's Christian Bale being crazy.
Rosie! Girls! They're coming.
Oh, dear God.
Mommy, what's happening?
There are people coming for our horses, sweetie. Lucy, grab Jacob. Remember our plan.
Sweetie, get away from the door!
Grab Jacob's fare.
I'll meet you at the top of the ridge.
Wesley, come with us.
If I don't, they're going to take it all or burn it down.
Let them. Please come.
Daddy,
run for the door,
come.
Girls. Run for the door. Please
run,
come.
Run, girls. Run!
Let's go, girls.
Go! Go!
Run, girls. Run!
Run!
Ouch. Okay, so even from that clip,
didn't end well.
That didn't end well. This is obviously a cowboy movie.
Yeah, it's a cowboy western movie that's trying to go at the western from slightly different angles. So I liked it for that. Directed by a guy by the name of Scott Cooper, who I was a big fan of his last film, Crazy Heart. If you remember Jeff Bridges as the country singer.
Film. Yeah, great
And
film.
Even Colin Farrell popped up and had sang a few songs. It's a very sweet film with a lot of heart. So he's aiming to kind of find that heart here again, because the idea here is that very, very opposite people are forced to spend time together. Christian Bale plays this army captain who is tasked. He's close to retirement, so he's very brutalized as well by years in the West and a lot of killing and rampaging and all of that stuff that went on. It's set in 1892. And he is tasked before he retires with bringing a Cheyenne Indian chief and his family, who've been held captive for 7 years by the Americans, to safety and bring him back home to a safe place because he's terminally ill, basically, and that this man has served his time and they deserve to show a bit of compassion. Mm. The backstory to all that is that the newspapers are getting wind of what's going on up here and they're starting to report it fairly unfavourably. So even though this Indian has been, or Native American Indian has been very, you know, violent towards him in the past and he's killed some of Christian Bale's best friends, actually, he is now expected to put himself potentially in harm's way to transport him back home. So it's a bit of a road movie. Very early on, they come across Rosamund Pike's character, who very early in the film sees her entire family wiped out and robbed by another Indian tribe. They distinguish between tribes here, which is interesting. So these were Comanche Indians.
Right.
She is completely traumatized and, you know, he takes her on the road with them and initially is absolutely terrified of the Native American community that she spends time with. So it's about whether these people can put their differences aside really for the sake of survival. And I thought it was good. It started really good, really well, but I have to say I found it a bit grim. There's a lot of downbeat stuff happens in it. And I'm kind of going, lads, it's January, you know?
Yeah. Has Christian Bale ever been in a comedy?
It's a good film, well told. And I think the reason I found it a bit grim was maybe the running time just, you know, expected too much of me. It's 2 hours 10.
Whoa.
And I think with a bit of trimming, maybe you'd have been much more on board because there's a lot of, it's a film about compassion, really. But there's a sense of deja vu to the actual story, I suppose. You've been here
before. It does feel like that. Yeah.
And I have to put up my hands and admit, I was force-fed Westerns by my older brothers when I was a kid.
Mm.
And I'm traumatised for life and it's still not exactly my genre. I would say if you're a fan of the classic old-style, old-school Westerns, though, you'll get a lot more from this.
Okay. Old-school Westerns are, you know, the way they were kind of reinvented a little bit there, you know, 10 years or so ago.
Yeah,
you know,
with Unforgiven and stuff like that.
Unforgiven, for instance,
yeah.
Is it more like in that vein?
No, it's not. It's not as powerful as that, I'll be honest. It's a good film. It's a little bit earnest and just a little bit downbeat, but I think it's beautifully shot. The performances are great. No, I would say, I'm not going 4 stars in it, but it's absolutely a 3-star film and you'll see a lot of better reviews for it. Like, it's not a bad film by any stretch. Yeah. You know,
That Greg Kinnear movie was called Flash of Genius, apparently, so you can look that up. The hashtag Temple Bar movies falling down, obviously, lots of people have that one, and Herpes Rides Again. Okay, good stuff. Thanks, Claire. Thanks, of course, to Tomás and Esther. Always a joy to have them in. Our production team today, Niamh Hassel, Claire Collins, Michael Quillian, Anne-Marie Kane and Elaine Power. Ivan's up next on News Talk. We'll talk to you Monday at 2. See you then.
Moncrief on News Talk.
With Gas Networks Ireland. Natural gas is compatible with a wide range of modern appliances. gasnetworks.ie/movetogas.